Let us get started. This is the talk, The Need for Trinitarian Imagination. I did have a small unrelated epiphany being out here in Atlanta. I'm, you know, born and raised California and then passed 16 years in Idaho. And I've always been intrigued with regional differences and especially how people in different regions insult one another. You know, there are in Europe, you know, you get southern part of France, northern part of France, and of course here we've got north and south, and we tend to just to forget the west unless you're out there. It's always sort of, you always feel left out on ESPN when, you know, the sports scores are so late, and you know, they just keep playing Yankees and Boston Red Sox over and over, highlights, and they never get to the west coast. But I've always wondered, you know, about east-west differences in the United States. And it struck me finally, I mean, of course there's more history out in the East, and so those in the East tend to look down on those in the West as, of course, newcomers, and we kind of enjoy that cowboy, you know, sort of thing at times, the wild kids on the block. But it struck me, trying to just be in contact with my own family, that people on the East Coast have to look at people on the West Coast, because of the time difference, as people who sleep in an awful lot. Right? You know, you're up at 6, and the people aren't even up in California, you know, until 10 o'clock. And then, you know, you go to bed like good, responsible people, and they're still up. So it's as if, you know, we're sort of bad frat boys out in the West. Very irresponsible, and so always the East Coast people have to be the elder siblings looking down their noses at the bad frat boys out West. But of course, we look back East as people, why are you getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning and then going to bed at 6, 7 o'clock at night? And so we look at you as sort of stuffy, hardworking farmers, but not really living it up. So anyway, just for what it's worth, this is a talk on the need for Trinitarian imagination, and so of course I do need to start with several poems, just to get us warmed up. A couple of Ted Kooser poems, and then Tony Hoagland. Some of you have heard these, not in talks here, but here's a Ted Kooser one called Student. The green shell of his backpack makes him lean into wave after wave of responsibility, and he swings his stiff arms and cupped hands, paddling ahead. He has extended his neck to its full length, and his chin, hard as a beak, breaks the cold surf. He's got his baseball cap on, backward, as he crawls out of the froth of a hangover and onto the sand of the future, and lumbers, heavy with hope, into the library. A little shot from Ted Kooser. And then another Ted Kooser. This one's A Jar of Buttons. A Jar of Buttons. This is a core sample from the floor of the Sea of Mending, a cylinder packed with shells that over many years sank through fathoms of shirts, pearl buttons, blue buttons, and settled together beneath waves of perseverance. An ocean upon which generations of women set forth under the sails of gingham curtains, and seated side by side on decks sometimes salted by tears, made small but important repairs. And then one last from Tony Hoagland. These are all contemporary poets. A little bit longer, a lot of great imagery and theme here. Candlelight. Cross the porch in the hazy dusk to worship the moon rising like a yellow filling station sign on the black horizon. You feel the faint grit of ant beneath your shoes, but keep on walking, because in this world you have to decide what you're willing to kill. Saving your marriage might mean dinner for two by candlelight on steak, raised on pasture, chopped out of a rainforest, whose absence might mean an atmospheric thinness 50 years from now, above the vulnerable head of your bald grandson on vacation, as the cells of his scalp, sautéed by solar radiation, break down like suspects under questioning. Still, you slice the sirloin into pieces and feed each other on silver forks under the approving gaze of a waiter whose purchased attention and French name are a kind of candlelight themselves. While in the background, the fingertips of the pianist float over the tusks of the slaughtered elephant without a care, as if the elephant had granted its permission. Okay. Well, one of the things that prompts this sort of talk is a perennial worry that I've had looking at Christian culture, trying to think about Christian culture over the years, and that is the very common failure of Protestant cultures, and our schools tend to be products of our church cultures. But what is intriguing, if you just look historically, is that Protestant churches and Protestant institutions tend not to last very long, and that should bother us in evangelical tradition. We have great moments of Protestant history, Puritans and Huguenots and Scottish Presbyterians and all sorts of wonderful things, pilgrims in colonial times. But it's always very striking to me that they last maybe two, three generations, and then they turn largely secular and leave behind a pretty bad track record after that. I mean, we know Harvard, Yale were good, strong Christian institutions, and then very quickly fell apart in the history of the U.S. And so I'm always looking at trying to understand, and it's a very complicated subject, and the answer, or one answer I'm trying to give today, isn't, of course, the only answer. There are 1,000 factors that play into that. But I do think we should be provoked to jealousy by some in Eastern Orthodoxy and in Roman Catholicism. For all their problems and corruptions from a Protestant angle, they have been able to hold on to entire countries and so forth, for good or ill, for many more generations than Protestants have. And so one shot at the answer to this, I think, a disturbing question is that we Protestants tend not to connect with the deeper issues of life. And one of those deeper issues, of course, is beauty and imagination. And I want to be able to talk about those in an interchangeable sort of way. Imagination and looking at imagination as sort of the appreciation of beauty beauty sort of playing off imaginative interests. So I do want to have that out there as a problem we need to think about, even if we solve it in different ways. Surely it's a characteristic of evangelical cultures that we are not obsessed with beauty, that we tend to be more obsessed with how we perceive truth and doctrine and getting things straight there. And there's a plus and a glory to that as we contribute to Christendom. But there is this sad feature as well. And I think, so the question becomes, why are we losing later generations, especially when Scripture promises us those generations, right? If you're faithful, then your kids will do this and this, and they'll be blessed here and blessed there. And we tend to be wiped out very quickly. You know, there is no great, you know, Scottish Presbyterian comic tradition, or there is no great Huguenot tradition of theater, you know, things like that. That's just not on our horizon. We tend to be really good martyrs and then vanish. And there must be more to it than that, I think. because in a very serious way, it's relatively easy to be a martyr. The issues tend to be very clear, right? The Romans are sending the lions, and you know what to do in that circumstance. It's much harder when you're wrestling with secular approaches to beauty, or you're being inundated with secular accounts of beauty and theater and so forth, and you're trying to figure out what to do, how to be faithful in an overwhelmingly secular culture. I think it's much harder to be faithful there than in the Colosseum. So I want to keep those as sort of the motivating pressure in this, and bringing it down in a very practical level, is we have to think about that in terms of as being teachers, in terms of schools as well. It's very easy for the classical tradition to make beauty something on the side, to make the good life something on the side that you get to in the old-fashioned American way. But here at our school, we learn truth, and that's all that's important. So I do think this is the way it ends up being a problem in our schools. It tends to be a reflection of the broader Protestant culture. If we need to work on both, and it's how it shows up in our families and churches as well. So all these institutions really need to address and come to grips with this problem. Why are we so short-lived? And why is it that we're not inspiring the next generation the way secularists? I mean, for all the curses on secularism, they tend to inspire the next generation. You know, it changes. You look at the secular culture from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, but they pass on their faith quite convincingly to the next generation, and the next generation is inspired to go out and do the same sort of garbage. So why is it that we're not inspiring? And as I say, I think it has to do with our marginalization of imagination and beauty, and I think those things are right at the heart of Trinitarian life. So I want to try to bring out some of those. And ideally, in a very practical way, the idea is to be able to take some of these things, meditate on them, and put them to work in the classroom, at least be thinking about beauty, whatever the subject might be, not just classes on art. I'm not even relatively interested in classes on art so much as how do you teach, how do you inspire with a physics class, with a literature class, with physical education, thinking in aesthetic terms. So I hope to give you some handles to be able to think about that. And again, not just in the classroom, but in our own families, where our children are inspired first to want to imitate us or turn away from us. Now, we know this is a very big question in Scripture because we get this other problem put in our face in Scripture, and that's this fact that Christian culture is supposed to be attractive and also alienating. Christian culture is supposed to be attractive and also alienating. Think of passages like Deuteronomy 4, which I want to contend is an aesthetic passage. We see the Lord saying, I have taught you the decrees and laws as the Lord my God commanded me, Moses speaking, so that you may follow them in the land you are entering to take possession of it. Observe them, he will say. Notice this, observe these commandments, and in other words, observe this culture carefully, for this will show your wisdom and understanding to the nations, who will hear about all these decrees and say, surely this great nation is a wise and understanding people. So Israel was supposed to live out a particular life. The law of God was an expression of God's character, and so the law is described as a gift, and they were supposed to look good. This law was supposed to make them look good, the culture it produced look good. And then the pagan nations around it were supposed to look to Israel and say, wow, that's a really wise, interesting culture, and seek to imitate it. And so you attract the other nations without needing military conquest or things like that, though that was important in the old as well. You see this sort of at a mature level in 1 Kings 10. When the queen of Sheba heard about Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. And she arrives at Jerusalem, and Solomon answered all her questions. And when the queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, right, there's an aesthetic angle, the food on his table, the seating of his officials, the attending servants in their robes, his cupbearers, and the burnt offerings he made at the temple, she was overwhelmed, right? So there we get the Queen of Sheba, right, coming outside of Israel, looking at Israel and doing exactly what we had pictured in Deuteronomy 4. She was overwhelmed at the wisdom. And then we see more explicitly in Solomon's context that there was a tremendous amount of aesthetic concern in Solomon's kingdom. We find this not only an Old Testament feature, right, where we're told by Christ himself in the New Testament, Matthew 5, that you are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. So we too, as Christian culture, primarily I think in our churches, secondarily in our schools, but we are supposed to be a city set on a hill, something glorious, a place of refuge, a place people want to run into, not a place that is alienated from the gospel. And then finally, in the book of Revelation, we see that at the very end, the city had no need of the sun or of the moon, for the glory of God illuminated it. And the nations of those who are saved shall walk in its light, and the kings of the earth bring their glory and honor into it. So they bring their aesthetic gifts, their glory and their honor into it to even improve the kingdom. But it draws. So from beginning to end of Scripture, we see that the kingdom of God should be something very attractive to the pagan, should be very attractive to the non-Christian mind. And so whenever you're talking about attraction, you're already in the realm of beauty and ugliness. You're already in the realm of aesthetics. And so there is a heavy aesthetic element to Christian culture. And yet, in contrast to all this, we're also supposed to be alienating. You can imagine compromised Christian cultures that are beautiful and are unfaithful to the Lord. So there's this odd aspect to this attraction. You will be hated, Matthew 13:13. You will be hated by all for my name's sake. John 15, if the world hates you, you know that it hated me before it hated you. If you were of the world, then you would love its own. Yet because you are not of the world, but I chose you out of it, therefore the world hates you. So we need to be hated as well. And if you're in a Christian culture and we're not being hated, then that should be a hint as well that something is off. And you'll see different parts of the Christian church tend to emphasize one or the other. We should, you know, be loved always by those outside. And then you'll get, usually in our own sort of Protestant tradition, we should always be hated by those outside. And so it's easy to be hated. John 17, the world has hated them because they are not of the world, just as I am not of the world. So it seems like a good, healthy Christian culture is that we should be loved and hated at the same time. And how do you create that sort of effect? How do you keep that balance of doing things to be hated and doing things to be loved? And I want to suggest one way of doing this is to focus on beauty, because beauty has this very paradoxical, it produces a paradoxical response in people. It is seductive, right? Wall Street knows how powerful beauty is, and so we're constantly preached to with it via commercials and so forth. But there is this seduction. It softens people. It draws people in, men and women, different forms of beauty at times, but we are drawn to it. So there is the attractiveness that beauty provides. But beauty also provokes to envy. Beauty also provokes to envy. It also gets people angry. We see beauty and many times we want to tear it down. We see someone beautiful and we think of their ill motivations. We it naturally pushes us in the wrong direction. And it's that sort of combination of seduction and envy that we would expect in healthy Christian cultures. They should, on one way, want to imitate us and yet be envious of things the church has. And I'm not only speaking in terms of, you know, architecture and so forth, but if you've been in any sort of conflicts through your church and local communities, you know the non-Christians get very upset sometimes if you just have good, healthy families having fun. They get really upset about that. And it doesn't cost a lot of money just to be faithful in the small things as Christians. And so you'll see them trying to find ways to disturb your community if you stand out in any way. And so that envy, something they wish they had. They wish they had husbands who loved them. They wish they had children who loved their parents. And because they can't, they want to tear that down. So that sort of balance comes with the consideration of beauty just in the terms of family life. And it gets even more once you have beautiful buildings and are working in all sorts of the arts and so forth. So this seduction and envy should be characteristic of our cultures. And that's not something that I see jumping out in the history of Protestantism. Again, we tend to provoke people to anger sometimes. And again, there's a place for it. On doctrinal terms, fight among ourselves because we're concerned with truth. But we don't get the seductive part, right? Protestantism doesn't often look seductive. I mean, it's a bad name already. It's a negative connotation, Protestantism. So we talk in terms of evangelicalism, the gospel, and that's stronger in some ways. But we really want to focus on Christ because he was somebody who was seductive and envious. He wasn't handsome, we're told, but he projected the good life. He acted like a king. He acted in very aesthetic terms at times, not being ruffled by objectors and so forth. And yet they were so envious of him, what he was doing, they had to put him on the cross. So beauty is this very interesting thing. It doesn't require handsomeness, doesn't require great buildings. Those are nice luxuries down the road, but it does require a commitment to goodness and attractiveness. So what is, here's one of the problems we get into in this subject. Well, what is beauty? It's nice to wave your hands and talk about beauty, but what exactly is it? So I want to try to put some handles on this. Being as in the Christian tradition, we of course have to tie all the big words in Christian life, truth, beauty, and goodness, they all have to be tied to Christ. They all have to be tied to the Christian Godhead. They all have to be tied to the triune Godhead, Father, Son, and Spirit. And it's interesting to try to understand truth in terms of the Trinity and goodness in terms of the Trinity. And I want to make the case for beauty. If you want a simple definition of beauty, somehow, even if it doesn't make sense at first, is that the Trinity is beauty. We have to be able to say that at the end. Whatever is going on in the life of the Trinity is going to be our definition of beauty, our characterization, if you will. That's one beginning handle on it. And there's another one I'd like you to meditate on. And again, we have so much work to do in here. I can't really, lean on any of this in any dogmatic way, but we do need to begin meditating on it. But one 20th century theologian also described beauty as love made visible. Beauty is love made visible. Von Balthasar, a Roman Catholic theologian in the 20th century, part of the Trinitarian revival, trying to think about practical implications of the Trinity, described beauty as love made visible. And that fits with defining beauty as the Trinity, because we know at the heart of the Trinity is love. God is love. So somehow every attribute of God, all the big words, have to be defined in terms of love. So truth is going to be a kind of love. Goodness, easily a kind of love. But beauty as love made visible is very rich and interesting. It immediately makes you think, it makes you doubt certain kinds of beauty. Certainly there is a certain kind of beauty we would normally say in a fashion show with the supermodels. But if beauty is love made visible, then it really depends upon the people involved in that. If it's all selfish and consumerish, then that's not a form of beauty. But if there are people, and we should be concerned with fashion and style, that's part of the aesthetic, you can imagine people trying to be interested in fashion and style from a motivation of love for others and love for a community. So it would immediately help us draw lines if you think of beauty as love made visible. Certainly sort of the arrogant handsomeness or an arrogant beauty in a person is not going to be real beauty. Whereas, the old woman giving the mite, giving the bit of money that Jesus praises, that is going to be a picture of beauty in a certain way. She is making love visible there. And of course, right at the heart of Christian gospel is the incarnation, right? The appearance of Christ there, even though he's not handsome, we're told, the appearance of Christ in bodily form is love made visible. That's what the incarnation is. So in a very important way, beauty is love made visible. So I encourage you to think about that. Now, whichever direction we go on beauty, I want to highlight point number three as well. And this is something we tend to downplay over the past 300 years as well. And that is the centrality of personality. The centrality. And this ties into Trinity. This ties into love made visible. But we know at the heart of our universe is personality. At the heart of our universe is a society. Mysteriously one, but importantly differentiated, Father, Son, and Spirit. And so personality, style, and I want to say as well in their imagination, are crucial to our understanding of trying to solve this problem. Why Protestant cultures fail, why our schools aren't always, don't have an aesthetic dimension to them, except on the margins. And I think it's because personality is very difficult. It's mysterious. Again, non-Christians are light years ahead in some ways of understanding and selling personality, understanding personality. Protestants, we tend to live in crisis mode most of the time, right? Our name tells us that we're still fighting this battle. We're always at war. And again, there's an important part to that. But if you're always at war, I mean, imagine World War II. If you're always at war, then beauty falls off to the side. You don't have time when you're fighting Hitler to be concerned with pretty buildings because he's bombing them and so forth. And so if you're always in crisis mode, then you can't understand the depths and riches of beauty. So we're hindered by that sort of thing. And you can't focus on the power of personality. Again, personality could be another way of saying the good life, of being really human. And this is one of the biggest things, I think, that we have a problem with in trying to evangelize the non-Christian world by our communities. We're still at this point, and I'm speaking of evangelical personality throughout the United States. Different story, of course, in Europe and so forth. They've got bigger problems. But a large part of our evangelism has to be, over the next 50 years, proving that we're human, right? Proving that we're human. Imagine, still watch, even though there's been quick improvement, watch how Christians are portrayed in film still. We're still the wackos. Okay, we're still the people who are nasty and angry and bitter and wanting to use rules to slow people down and so forth. And of course, it's a brilliant rhetorical move on the part of secularists. They should portray their enemies, us, in that way because people recognize that type, the Pharisee, right? So we're portrayed as Pharisees and not really human yet. And this is a key part. I mean, if you've got students that are constantly getting that propaganda that real life is what is secular life, look, they're happy, they tell jokes, and they know when to break the rules, whereas Christians always keep to the rules no matter what, then our students start recognizing early on which is the better life. And so it's crucial to be able to win that battle. And again, it's something that takes decades, but could start in your own family, in your own classroom. So the centrality of personality involves proving that we're human, proving that we can. You think of, you know, I often point to comic traditions and comedy traditions because that's a large part of culture that Protestants don't want to have anything to do. Sure, we crack our jokes and so forth, but it should be odd to us that, you know, we can point to a Hispanic comedic tradition. You can name the stand-up comics in the Latino world. You can certainly do it in Jewish culture, right? There's a strong comic tradition in Jewish culture. But Presbyterian culture? You know, see, we laugh. There are no great Presbyterian comics, right? There are no great Presbyterian playwrights, right? That sort of thing. And that suggests something's out of kilter. We're not really human yet, and I think, until we get our own comedic tradition. And again, that's something that takes a long time. But even if we started working on it, right, it would take a long time. But the problem is we don't even care about it, right? We're happy to live off the secularist comedy and teach our kids comedy through the secularist. And there's a lot of quality work being done there. But it's not our own yet. We're not acting like kings and queens that Christ asked us to be and covering all of life. We're not writing the great tragedies, the great comedies that we need to prove that we're human. So that's all tied into the centrality of personality. Certainly the Trinity does this, and I'll get to that in a moment. So key words there, style and personality. I want to talk in a moment about Trinitarian style. Let me turn, in a sense, to the subjective side of this question of beauty, or the interior side, not really subjective. But what is imagination? What is imagination? And the first line I have there is, living in the subjunct. So when I say imagination, I'm talking about a faculty in us, part of our brains, minds, a faculty, pardon me, that manipulates images. It manipulates its imagination. So it has to do primarily with images. It involves sound and taste and touch and all those things that come through our senses. And I want to suggest, first of all, that the imagination is about living in the subjunctive. And those of you who teach languages or know languages, you know that when we talk about the subjunctive, we're talking about the world of hoping, the world of wishing, the way we're sort of thinking things could be, right? And imagination plays into that. Imaginative works tell us a story, like Tolkien does, about an entirely different world. They tell us a story, like Dostoevsky does, about a gritty world struggling with the gospel. But is that living in the subjunctive that is so very important? And again, let me throw just basic scriptural things that we tend to strip of all beauty. But we do know in the New Testament that faith, hope, and love are the premier virtues. Faith, hope, and love our premier virtues. And I want you to stare at those things, right? Faith, hope, and love all require imagination, huge amounts of imagination, huge amounts of reconfiguring, repicturing the world contrary to what it is, right? Faith, we know that we do not look at the things the way they are. We're looking toward a future hope. And all the language, all the exhortations, you could, I'd say, translate faith, hope, and love all the way through Scripture as use your imagination this way. Use your imagination this way. Even love, right? The greatest of the virtues. You look at fantastically poetic passage that we get too used to in 1 Corinthians 13. We read over and over at weddings. It is some of the most amazing poetry. He's actually describing in 1 Corinthians 13 the very character of God, right? Someone who love is kind. Love does not remember. Right? This is he's talking about Father, Son, and Spirit at work among one another there, but in relation to us as well. But notice what love is called to do. Love overlooks. Right? Love overlooks small pettinesses. Well, that's an act of imagination. We have to perceive the goodness of those around us, even when they're not being good to us. We have to notice Christ loves the unlovable, right? Christ loves the ugly. He overcomes his aversion to ugliness by renaming us, making us beautiful and uniting us to him. And so love is a hugely imaginative work. And so perhaps, I mean, this explains why one aspect of why Protestant cultures fail. We're not very imaginative. And so if you're not imaginative or you're hostile to imagination, you're not going to be good at faith, hope, and love either. And so that's going to be a huge cultural detriment along the way. Well, I've got a section there, imaging versus perceiving. I don't think I will go into that. I have several distinctions between just, you know, our perceiving of the world around us and imaging it. Let me just highlight one of them, is that, you know, the pictures that we have in our heads that we can imagine, if I ask you to imagine a unicorn up here and actually looking at a tiger in a zoo, the difference between those is that our imagination is always tied to our will. We can create an image of a unicorn, a green unicorn up on the wall if we want, and we do that by will. But the perceiving world around us is resistant to our will. I open my eyes and the speaker is there. No matter what I want to do, if I keep turning my head, the speaker shows up there. Whereas I can put the unicorn here or here or here. I can picture it behind me. It's dependent upon my will. So as we're understanding what is imagination, we have to understand that it's highly tied to our will, good or bad wills, and there are very interesting connections there. And there are other differences between imaging and perceiving. And if you want to look at a philosophical treatment of those differences, Colin McGinn, British philosopher, has done some interesting work there. But the last one there, imagination and meaning. Imagination and meaning. When we're trying to, again, understand the good life or how life operates around us or just to live in terms of faith, hope, and love, we're trying to figure out the meaning of the chaos, the trivialities, you know, doing the dishes for the 1,200th time, trying to figure out the meaning behind these sorts of things. And imagination plays heavily into that. And I mentioned in another talk the importance of living in the world of the book of Ecclesiastes, right? It's the world of vanity. It's the world of repetition. It's the world of trivial things time and time again. And the exhortation of that is somehow you have to rise above the trivialities of life and keep the big picture in mind. In other words, you have to use your imagination. You have to keep the big picture always in mind when you're interacting with other Christians, when you're teaching your students, because it's so easy to be tripped up by the petty uglinesses of life. And so one way to capture this, different ways to think, I think this is what opera is trying to do. I've puzzled at opera for years, trying to figure out exactly what are they trying to accomplish in that art. And being an American, it's hard for me to engage, though I know something great's going on. I just can't really figure it out there. But at least one argument in favor of opera is that music tends to bind things together, right? Perhaps an easier way of thinking of this is the power of the iPod. Walking through a town with your MP3 player and music playing, it feels as if you're in a film, right? I do this myself, and you can block other things out, and the music that's playing really makes things look good or bad. You know, you can walk through the mall, tragic state, you know, some sad music playing, or, you know, something upbeat. And it really does add meaning to your walk in a very trivial way. And so I'm thinking opera is doing that at a large level, where we're always singing in an opera, right? There's no just plain talking. Even when they're talking, they're singing. And so it's a way to sort of bring meaning to all of life, perhaps. And so I'm speaking in favor of opera. Music in film, of course, does that. It tells us the meaning of a scene, and listening to your iPod walking down the street does the same sort of thing. It helps us remember what's important. And that's what imagination is supposed to do. It's that permanent iPod attached to us. Through, you know, through school, through church, through every trivial event, if we have the music of God playing in our ears, then we're able to encounter. And perhaps that's one way to summarize the Christian life again, looking on the things that are permanent, right? We're called to do. Paul calls us to do, remembering the big picture, and so music is one picture of that. So imagination then is the means of capturing life, is the means of understanding what's really behind all the pettiness we're surrounded with. So those are some hints about beauty, some hints about receiving beauty and the power of imagination that I think we tend to neglect. Let me turn to section 3 on the outline, which is secular versus Trinitarian imagination. And this comes to play in our schools as well. At some very important level, in a winsome way, in an attractive way, part of our job in the school is to show the glory of one picture, the Christian gospel, and to show the ugliness, highlight the ugliness of another picture, the secular story. And so we do need to be thinking in terms of that antithesis. There is this stark division between Christian light and non-Christian darkness. And we often do that just in terms of truth. We often do that just in terms of truth, you know, debates, and important. There are places for all this, debates over evolution, looking at the evidence, pro and con, and so forth. But in the end, overall, that tends not to be as inspiring when you just focus on truth. Certainly it attracts a certain form of mind, but unless you get to beauty, it's not going to. So one way of interacting with secular culture is not only in terms of truth, but also in terms of goodness and beauty, and the line I have there sort of attempts to capture this, why secularism is boring. We need to be able to show why secularism is boring and unexciting, and think about that and convince our students, not just intellectually, though that's a part, but by our own lives. And you can highlight that in family life as well, just looking at the secular culture around you and being thankful that you've got mother and father who love you, that sort of thing. But it is important always to compare the stories. Secularism tells a story, and we need to be able to critique that story from the angle of beauty and not just from the angle of truth. And again, I'm not pitting those things against one another. I think, of course, the beautiful at the bottom is going to be truth, and truth at the bottom is going to be beautiful. It's mysterious in that way, like the Trinity. So it's important to be constantly comparing those stories. So let's think about it. What if secularism, and I'll just pick, you know, a very common form of secularism, something like Darwinism. Darwinism as a story, predominant in our culture, in our particular American expression or, you know, Enlightenment expression, Darwinism and individualism tend to be closely hooked. Standing on your own, being your own person, that's tied into a Darwinian picture of things. So that's a story. What is that story? Well, we sort of evolved out of this mush and developed over time, and there's something praiseworthy about that, and now we fight as individuals and believe in human rights and that sort of thing. And that's a typical secular story in our culture. How will it end? We don't know. We're sort of frightened. We could devolve. We could, you know, be warmed to death by the globe. We don't know how the story is going to end, but that's part of the secular story. And I want to suggest these are aesthetic critiques of that story. Here are some critiques. Well, that's weak characterization. Right? When we look at a good story, we want to have interesting characters. And interesting characters like a Hamlet or like an Indiana Jones or something like that, we're drawn to that sort of character. But secularism doesn't really give place for interesting characters. In fact, most of the characters in the secular story are hypocrites. right? So most of the stories, I mean, if they were true to, as we commonly say, if they're true to Darwinian principle, then they would act like apes and lions and so forth. But they don't. They want to act like monks and nuns. They do want to talk about human rights and protecting individual life and free speech and so forth. But in a Darwinian picture, that's just hypocritical, right? And so part of the story is that secularism is made up of a huge amount of hypocrites. Why can't you become a secularist? Well, there are too many hypocrites in that story. I just can't go there. You know, I wish I could find somebody that believed in evolution, but I don't see any neighbor tackling another neighbor and biting his throat out. I mean, once in a while, there are, you know, serial killers that do that, consistent Darwinists, but I don't see any of you secularists really believing that, and so I can't be drawn to your story. It's just full of hypocrisy. Notice also in the secular story that there's really the lack of interesting conflict. Any great story has got tension, has got conflict. Think of the movies you like, the stories you like, whether it's Jane Austen or Bruce Willis, you know, right? So I didn't mean to put them on the same level. But there's always going to be great conflict, great tension in those stories. Right? I'm trying to get men and women in that too. So Bruce Willis and Jane Austen. But there's always great conflict. Within the first, you know, part of that story, we have to find out what the conflict is. What does the character in a Jane Austen novel want? And what is standing in her way? What does Bruce Willis want? And what is standing in his way? And we're hooked into that. We're interested. And that's great storytelling. But in the secular story, there's none of that, right? The most interesting tension is between persons in good literature and good film. And yet in the secular story, we don't have interesting conflicts because we don't really have people, right? We are products of evolution, and so all the great aspects of tragic life, you know, guilt and envy, all those crucial things for good storytelling, again, more hypocrisy. And you know, who cares if an antelope is guilty, or who cares if the lion is guilty? You just can't even talk about that in a secular context. So it's a lot of fake conflict. The story is forced. They really don't have grounds for interesting conflict in the secular story or interesting tension. It's all survival of the fittest. And then the next story should be survival of the fittest. And the next one, survival of the fittest. Well, that gets a little tedious after a while. And of course, number four, there is no theme. There is no unifying theme to it. Every great, I mean, we learn this from Aristotle on. Every great play, every great film, every great novel has got an interesting theme that's being acted out scene by scene. There's a theme that unifies it. You know, revenge leads to self-destruction, the theme that appears of Hamlet. And so every scene contributes to that, and every scene is unified because it's masterfully done together. But, of course, there are no big themes except survival of the fittest. Survival of the fittest. There's no truth, beauty, and goodness in a Darwinian universe, though they're trying more and more to make a case for it. And then finally, there's this sentimental preachiness within secularism. We tend not to like sentimental stories. And that doesn't mean emotional stories. Sentimental has to do with an aversion to pain, an aversion to evil, a resentment of evil. And of course, secularism is all about that. Whenever something bad happens in a secular universe, the characters in that story, friends in your neighborhood, are always the victims, right? The secular story, everyone's innocent. There is no fall in the secular story. Another bad aspect of their story. There's no fall. It's all sort of natural. But so when anything bad happens, some tragedy, cancer, war, whatever it might be, it's always undeserved in the secular mind. And so they're always acting as victims. It shouldn't be this way. They resent the evil. They don't like it. And that ends up making the whole secular story over and over. Just watch the news. What are they lamenting? They're lamenting they're being punished or chastised and so forth. And I'll get to the Christian different angle on that. But there's this sentimental preachiness. It all becomes sort of a Hallmark card ethics within the secular view. So that's part of the case, and you can think about it on your own, but that's trying to understand the secular story from an aesthetic angle. How do we criticize a novel? How do we criticize a non-Christian film? Well, that should apply to the whole worldview as well, and somehow we have to convey it not just by lectures like this, but in our lives and in the story that we tell. So the Trinitarian imagination, in contrast to all that, expresses a divine style. And And this is getting back to some of the paradoxical power of beauty. I've talked about beauty as love made visible, beauty as Trinity. Now, more specifically, what does that mean? And I want to pull out, in other words, I want to look at how the triune personality works throughout biblical history. What are some of those characteristics? And because our time is short, I'll be waving my hands a lot here, but hopefully you can connect. And the idea is to give you things that we're not comfortable with most of the time. Because we're not thinking in Trinitarian patterns. We tend to think in more Unitarian patterns. But let's look at some of this. If the Trinity is the deepest, most profound personality, the relationship between Father, Son, and Spirit, how does that Godhead express himself throughout biblical history, and especially in nature and so forth? Well, one is a terrifying beauty, right? This depth and profundity. Profundity talks about, you know, beneath the foundations or at the foundations, that at the very depth, there is a genuine depth of life. Notice in the secular story, you just always have to be cynical, right? Think of a lot of 80s comedy, 80s film. You're always cynical about things because there really is no depth to life. You don't want to have deep rituals. You can't appreciate weddings or funerals because it's just all play acting. But in a Trinitarian universe, there really is deep profundity that we will never get to the bottom of. And that should be a characteristic of our lives, of our schools, of our families, that there is a depth that we cannot touch, but it's wonderful and it is a terrifying love in an important sense. Number two, we should understand that the Trinity is all about overflow, right? One of the common characteristics we see in Scripture is gifting and luxury and overdoing it, right? The gift of God just overwhelms and pours out all the time. This is the characteristic. Protestants, right? Good Scottish and Dutch Protestants were known for our stinginess, right? You talk about Dutch character and Scottish character. Well, stingy is what we're proud of, being thrifty, right? But that's not the Trinitarian characteristic, right? Doesn't mean God's irresponsible, but it does in a certain sense in terms of giving to others, not giving in an unselfish way, but overflow and light. Triune personality is often described as light, and light is not something that's easily capturable. It goes where you don't want it to go. And so there's this emphasis on excess, on giving, and especially gratitude. We know that gratitude is right at the heart of Christian life. In fact, that's how Paul distinguishes between secularists and Christians in Romans 1, right? They've given up on gratitude. They're no longer thankful. But if you understand what the Trinity is doing, then you're really grateful for hot water in your shower. You're really grateful for chocolate on your tongue and so forth. Well, number three is play and surprise and wildness. Think of surprise, first of all. Think of how many times, you know, just how surprise works normally. Surprise is we have certain expectations. I'm going home after work. And surprise is those expectations are turned inside out. There's a surprise party. It's a group of friends not expecting, and they all shout, and everyone's happy, and so forth. So that's a surprise, and that's a very common characteristic of triune God in history. We expect certain things, and then the donkey talks, right, in Balaam's ass. We expect certain things, and then the sun stops, and then, you know, the Red Sea opens. These are not our expectations. And the people that are open to that, like Abraham, right, he was willing, you know, he believed that God could raise someone from the dead. He had good imagination, and he understood how this crazy God works, that he could raise someone from the dead, even if he stabbed his own son. That's the picture we get in Hebrews. So Abraham is someone that knew that God was a God of surprises. The cross itself is described as a big trick on Satan, right? If Satan would have known what would have happened, he wouldn't have done this sort of thing, if the enemies had have known that. So play, surprise, and then wildness, of course, is just looking at Job chapters, you know, 39, 40, and 41, and hear God boasting about these animals that he's made, right? And the wild animals, and the horses that run, and the lions that need food, and how he thinks the ostrich is stupid, and so forth, right? This is a personality that reveals himself in his creatures, right? Ugly creatures, beautiful creatures, but this is a person with style. This is Father, Son, and Spirit with deep style. So depth and profundity, overflow, surprise and wildness. And yet, number four, we get real difference and real tension, right? Within the Trinity, it's not just one God, one person. We get one God, three persons. And it's very important in the history of Trinitarian thought that the Son is different than the Father, that the Father is different than the Spirit, right? The church fathers did a great amount of work making that clear. It's not just one God wearing masks. That's a traditional heresy. These are somehow, mysteriously, very distinct. They are distinct persons, and yet they are one God. And that is the background for good tension, for good conflict. We see this, of course, come to its height when you've got Christ before the cross saying, "Not my will, but thine." There is huge and fascinating and mysterious difference going on there. And that forms the background. Whatever is happening in the Trinity, that forms the background for an interesting story when we get to the fall and we're interacting with evil and trying to tell our story and so forth. Somehow that's mysteriously reflected in the deep difference of a triune life. And of course, there is real unity and real cohesion. There is a oneness in God's story and a oneness of God himself. And so everything is connected like a great play by theme. Looking at a couple of others, mystery and indirectness. Indirectness is a huge part of divine life. He doesn't explain things, as we should in our schools, and grammar stage explaining things step by step, that's important and crucial. But we know that God often speaks through proverbs. He often speaks mysteriously. That, you know, it's wonderful when Christ says something provocative and doesn't go and try to fix it, right? When he talks about eating my body, some disciples leave and he doesn't run after them and say, "No, this is what I meant. I was just speaking figuratively. I'm not a cannibal," right? He's got that kingly confidence not to do that. Some will be offended at the mystery and indirectness of the Trinitarian personality. And then, of course, concrete expressiveness, right? We get God's character through the created order, through the trees, through Georgia peaches, through all sorts of very concrete things. And, of course, communal communication. We get God speaking in terms of love for one another. Let me look at 9 and 10 quickly. Eschatology and closure. There is an end to our story. You really don't have a satisfying story, as in secularism, if it just goes on and on forever. But we do get an end. There is an eschatology. There is a goal where everything, every tear is wiped away. And like any good play or novel, it comes to an end and we're satisfied. And that's what we're promised in the Christian story. And then finally, we know that the Christian gospel itself is a comic story overall, that it does have a happy ending where everyone is married. Right? That's how we often divide between comedy and tragedy versus a secular view where resentment, right? Resentment against any evil. In a Trinitarian context, we know that evil is healthy for us in a certain way. God puts evil in our way. God puts cancer. God causes evil to occur in a city so that we grow up, so that we mature, so that we're not just resentful victims. It's for our good. So in a very profound sense, going back to the earlier worries about Protestant culture, as King Henry V says at the end of the play, Shakespeare's play, that we ought to be makers of fashion, right? Catherine says, you know, it's not the style of French young ladies to kiss before they're married. And he says, you know, I'm the king of England now. You're the queen of England, and we ought to be makers of fashion. And so we ought to be the ones overall being able to make these aesthetic judgments, because that is our job. We are called to nobility. We are to live like kings and queens, and there's still going to be an offense to that. If the Christian church acted like kings and queens, we're going to be attractive, and we're also going to alienate. Who made you king? Is going to be the envious claim against us. But right now, people don't even care. Don't even care what we have to offer. Aren't offended by us and are not attracted by us. So our goal is in our schools, in our families, and especially our churches, to be a city on a hill. And that's the background for the need of Trinitarian imagination. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.